Chapter 43. Luke thoroughly played out. And you haven't told me, he broke off, conscious of going farther than he had meant. She saw the struggle and understood it. Understood also the nature of the spell to which he yielded as, with his eyes on her face, he began again abruptly, colon, what on earth did you mean by saying just now that you were learning to be a milliner? Just what I said. I am an apprentice at Regina's. Good Lord, you? But what for? I knew your aunt had turned you down. Mrs. Fisher told me about it. But I understood you got a legacy from her. I got $10,000. But the legacy is not to be paid till next summer. Well, but look here. You could borrow on it any time you wanted. She shook her head gravely. And no, for I owe it already. Owe it? The whole $10,000? Every penny. She paused, and then continued abruptly, with her eyes on his face, colon, I think Gus Treanor spoke to you once about having made some money for me in stocks. She waited, and Rosedale, congested with embarrassment, muttered that he remembered something of the kind. He made about $9,000, Lily pursued, in the same tone of eager communicativeness. At the time, I understood that he was speculating with my own money. It was incredibly stupid of me, but I knew nothing of business. Afterward I found out that he had not used my money, that what he said he had made for me, he had really given me. It was meant in kindness, of course, but it was not the sort of obligation one could remain under. Unfortunately, I had spent the money before I discovered my mistake, and so my legacy will have to go to pay it back. That is the reason why I am trying to learn a trade. She made the statement clearly, deliberately, with pauses between the sentences, so that each should have time to sink deeply into her hearer's mind. As he had a passionate desire that someone should know the truth about this transaction, and also that the rumor of her intention to repay the money should reach Judy Treanor's ears. And it had suddenly occurred to her that Rosedale, who had surprised Treanor's confidence, was the fitting person to receive and transmit her version of the facts. As he had even felt a momentary exhilaration at the thought of thus relieving herself of her detested secret. But the sensation gradually faded in the telling, and as she ended her pallor was suffused with a deep blush of misery. Rosedale continued to stare at her in wonder. But the wonder took the turn as he had least expected. But see here, if that's the case, it cleans you out altogether? P307 greater than, he put it to her, as if as he had not grasped the consequences of her act, as if her incorrigible ignorance of business were about to precipitate her into a fresh act of folly. Altogether yes, she calmly agreed. He sat silent, his thick hands clasped on the table, his little puzzled eyes exploring the recesses of the deserted restaurant. See here, that's fine, he exclaimed abruptly. Lily rose from her seat with a deprecating laugh. Oh, no, it's merely a bore, she asserted, gathering together the ends of her feather scarf. Rosedale remained seated, too intent on his thoughts to notice her movement. Miss Lily, if you want any backing I like, Pluck broke from him disconnectedly. Thank you. She held out her hand. Your tea has given me a tremendous backing. I feel equal to anything now. Her gesture seemed to show a definite intention of dismissal, but her companion had tossed a bill to the waiter and was slipping his short arms into his expensive overcoat. Wait a minute, you've got to let me walk home with you, he said. Lily uttered no protest, and when he had paused to make sure of his change they emerged from the hotel and crossed 6th Avenue again. As she led the way westward past a long line of areas which, through the distortion of their painless rails, revealed with increasing candor the disject a member of bygone dinners, Lily felt that Rosedale was taking contemptuous note of the neighborhood. And before the doorstep at which she finally paused he looked up with an air of incredulous disgust. This isn't the place? Someone told me you were living with Miss Farish. No. I am boarding here. I have lived too long on my friends. He continued to scan the blistered brownstone front, the windows draped with discolored lace, and the pompian decoration of the muddy vestibule. Then he looked back at her face, and said with a visible effort, "Colin, you'll let me come and see you someday?" She smiled, recognizing the heroism of the offer to the point of being frankly touched by it. "Thank you, I shall be very glad," she made answer, in the first sincere words as he had ever spoken to him. That evening in her own room, Miss Bartu had fled early from the heavy fumes of the basement dinner table, sat musing upon the impulse which had led her to unbosom herself to Rosedale. Beneath it she discovered an increasing sense of loneliness, a dread of returning to the solitude of her room, while she could be anywhere else, or in any company but her own. Circumstances, of late, had combined to cut her off more and more from her few remaining friends. On Carrie Fisher's part, the withdrawal was perhaps not quite involuntary. Having made her final effort on Lily's behalf, and landed her safely in me, Regina's workroom, Mrs. Fisher seemed disposed to rest from her labors, and Lily, understanding the reason, could not condemn her. Carrie had in fact come dangerously near to being involved in the episode of Mrs. Norma Hatch, and it had taken some verbal ingenuity to extricate herself. She frankly owned to having brought Lily and Mrs. Hatch together, but then she did not know Mrs. Hatch. She had expressly warned Lily that she did not know Mrs. Hatch, and besides, she was not Lily's keeper, and really the girl was old enough to take care of herself. Carrie did not put her own case so brutally, but she allowed it to be thus put for her by her latest bosom friend, Mrs. Jack Stepney. Mrs. Stepney, trembling over the narrowness of her only brother's escape, but eager to vindicate Mrs. Fisher, at whose house she could count on the ollie parties which had become a necessity to her since marriage had emancipated her from the Van Osburgh point of view. Lily understood the situation, and could make allowances for it. Carrie had been a good friend to her in difficult days, and perhaps only a friendship like Gertie's could be proof against such an increasing strain. Gertie's friendship did indeed hold fast, yet Lily was beginning to avoid her also. For she could not go to Gertie's without risk of meeting Selden, and to meet him now would be pure pain. It was pain enough, even to think of him, whether she considered him in the distinctness of her waking thoughts, or felt the obsession of his presence through the blur of her tormented nights. That was one of the reasons why he had turned again to Mrs. Hatch's prescription. In the uneasy snatches of her natural dreams he came to her sometimes in the old guise of fellowship and tenderness, and she would rise from the sweet delusion mocked and emptied of her courage. But in the sleep which the phial procured she sank far below such half-waking visitations, sank into depths of dreamless annihilation from which she woke each morning with an obliterated past. Gradually, to be sure, the stress of the old thoughts would return, but at least they did not importune her waking hour. The drug gave her a momentary illusion of complete renewal, from which she drew strength to take up her daily work. The strength was more and more needed as the perplexities of her future increased. She knew that to Gertie and Mrs. Fisher she was only passing through a temporary period of probation, since they believed that the apprenticeship she was serving at me, Regina's, would enable her, when Mrs. Peniston's legacy was paid, to realize the vision of the green and white shop with the fuller competence acquired by her preliminary training. But to Lily herself, aware that the legacy could not be put to such a use, the preliminary training seemed a wasted effort. She understood clearly enough that, even if she could ever learn to compete with hands formed from childhood for their special work, the small pay she received would not be a sufficient addition to her income to compensate her for such drudgery. And the realization of this fact brought her recurringly face to face with the temptation to use the legacy in establishing her business. Once installed, and in command of her own workwomen, she believed that he had sufficient tact and ability to attract a fashionable clientele, and if the business succeeded she could gradually lay aside money enough to discharge her debt to Treanor. but the task might take years to accomplish, even if she continued to stint herself to the utmost, and meanwhile her pride would be crushed under the weight of an intolerable obligation. These were her superficial considerations, but under them lurked the secret dread that the obligation might not always remain intolerable. She knew she could not count on her continuity of purpose, and what really frightened her was the thought that she might gradually accommodate herself to remaining indefinitely in Trina's debt, as S.E. had accommodated herself to the part allotted her on the Sabrina, and as S.E. had so nearly drifted into acquiescing with Stancy's scheme for the advancement of Mrs. Hatch. Her danger lay, as she knew, in her old incurable dread of discomfort and poverty, in the fear of that mounting tide of dinginess against which her mother had so passionately warned her. And now a new vista of peril opened before her. She understood that Rosedale was ready to lend her money, and the longing to take advantage of his offer began to haunt her insidiously. It was of course impossible to accept a loan from Rosedale, but proximate possibilities hovered temptingly before her. She was quite sure that he would come and see her again, and almost sure that, if he did, she could bring him to the point of offering to marry her on the terms as he had previously rejected. Would she still reject them if they were offered? More and more, with every fresh mischance befalling her, did the pursuing fury seem to take the shape of Bertha Dorset, and close at hand, safely locked among her papers, lay the means of ending their pursuit. The temptation, which her scorn of Rosedale had once enabled her to reject, now insistently returned upon her, and how much strength was left her to oppose it? What little there was, must at any rate be husbanded to the utmost. She could not trust herself again to the perils of a sleepless night. Through the long hours of silence the dark spirit of fatigue and loneliness crouched upon her breast, leaving her so drained of bodily strength that her morning thoughts swam in a haze of weakness. The only hope of renewal lay in the little bottle at her bedside, and how much longer that hope would last she dared not conjecture. Lily, lingering for a moment on the corner, looked out on the afternoon spectacle of Fifth Avenue. It was a day in late April, and the sweetness of spring was in the air. It mitigated the ugliness of the long crowded thoroughfare, blurred the gaunt roof lines, threw a mauve veil over the discouraging perspective of the side streets, and gave a touch of poetry to the delicate haze of green that marked the entrance to the park. As Lily stood there, she recognized several familiar faces in the passing carriages. The season was over, and its ruling forces had disbanded. But a few still lingered, delaying their departure for Europe, or passing through town on their return from the south. Among them was Mrs. Van Osburgh, swaying majestically in her C-spring barouche, with Mrs. Percy Grice at her side, and the new heir to the Grice millions enthroned before them on his nurse's knees. They were succeeded by Mrs. Hatch's electric Victoria, in which that lady reclined in the lonely splendor of a spring toilet obviously designed for company, and a moment or two later came Judy Treanor, accompanied by Lady Skiddaw, who had come over for her annual tarpon fishing, and a dip into P Street. This fleeting glimpse of her past served to emphasize the sense of aimlessness with which Lily at length turned toward home. She had nothing to do for the rest of the day, nor for the days to come, for the season was over in millinery as well as in society, and a week earlier Regina had notified her that her services were no longer required. Regina always reduced her staff on the 1st of May, and Miss Bart's attendance had of late been so irregular as he had so often been unwell, and had done so little work when she came, that it was only as a favor that her dismissal had hitherto been deferred. Lily did not question the justice of the decision. She was conscious of having been forgetful, awkward and slow to learn. It was bitter to acknowledge her inferiority even to herself, but the fact had been brought home to her that as a breadwinner she could never compete with professional ability. Since S.E. had been brought up to be ornamental, she could hardly blame herself for failing to serve any practical purpose, but the discovery put an end to her consoling sense of universal efficiency. As she turned homeward, her thoughts shrank in anticipation from the fact that there would be nothing to get up for the next morning. The luxury of lying late in bed was a pleasure belonging to the life of ease. It had no part in the utilitarian existence of the boarding house. She liked to leave her room early, and to return to it as late as possible, and she was walking slowly now in order to postpone the detested approach to her doorstep. But the doorstep, as she drew near it, acquired a sudden interest from the fact that it was occupied and indeed filled by the conspicuous figure of Mr. Rosedale, whose presence seemed to take on an added amplitude from the meanness of his surroundings. The sight stirred Lily with an irresistible sense of triumph. Rosedale, a day or two after their chance meeting, had called to inquire if S.E. had recovered from her indisposition. But since then S.E. had not seen or heard from him, and his absence seemed to betoken a struggle to keep away, to let her pass once more out of his life. If this were the case, his return showed that the struggle had been unsuccessful, for Lily knew he was not the man to waste his time in an ineffectual sentimental dalliance. He was too busy, too practical, and above all too much preoccupied with his own advancement to indulge in such unprofitable asides. In the peacock blue parlor, with its bunches of dried pampas grass and discolored steel engravings of sentimental episodes, he looked about him with unconcealed disgust, laying his hat distrustfully on the moldy console adorned with a Rogers statuette. Lily sat down on one of the plush and rosewood sofas, and he deposited himself in a rocking chair draped with a starched antimacassar which scraped unpleasantly against the pink fold of skin above his collar. "My goodness, you can't go on living here," he exclaimed. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.